Welcome to Thoughts on Record, podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. I'm your host, Dr. P. Kelly. Each week, we explore topics of interest relevant to mental health clinicians and consumers. That said, if you're generally interested in psychology, the brain, dynamics of human behavior, and other aspects of the incredible journey that is the human experience, you've come to the right place. Now, without further delay, here's today's episode. Dr. Leslie Becker Phelps is dedicated to helping people understand themselves and what they need to do to become more emotionally and psychologically healthy. She is in private practice, hosts a YouTube channel, and is a prolific writer. She has authored the Insecure in Love workbook, Insecure in Love, and Bouncing Back from Rejection. She also writes the Authentically You blog and the Making Change blog on Psychology Today. All right, Dr. Leslie Becker Phelps, welcome to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's good to be on here with you.
It's really wonderful to have you on the podcast today, as we'll no doubt discuss challenges related to attachment and relationships, especially in the context of romantic relationships, can evoke very strong emotions and behavioral urges that often, unfortunately, backfire, sometimes causing the very thing that clients fear most, which is the dissolution of the very relationship that they want to hang on to. Attachment and relationships are topics you've written and spoke about at great length, the most recent being your new workbook, the aptly titled The Insecure in Love Workbook. I'm really excited to walk through some of the core themes in your new workbook. As usual, I have far more questions than we likely have time for, so why don't we just jump in?
Sounds great.
Awesome. Okay, so one thing I'd like to ask all authors is, what inspired you to write the Insecure in Love workbook?
Well, for the workbook, what inspired it was that the first book, Insecure in Love, which came out in 2014, continues to do well. People are really still learning from it and gaining from it. And since then, I wrote a second book, Bounce Back from Rejection. And so as kind of a follow-up to the first one, I took a lot of the information from the second book and kind of added it. And I think it's going to help people even more. So that's the inspiration for that. The inspiration for Insecure in Love, you know, the whole, I guess, not quite a series, but two of them, was that I used to run a women's trauma program. And when I left that position, I really wanted to research, you know, what was going to be my interest, my fascination, where did I want to explore next? And what I came to understand is I kept wanting to know, when people get stuck in therapy, there's all these approaches we have, when they get stuck, what's getting people stuck? And the people in trauma are really stuck. And how can we help move them through? And so as I was trying to answer that question, I developed my own way of thinking about it, pulling together different approaches in therapy and integrating them. And so that was really the motivation for the workbook, the original book, and just the approach that I take.
Just to pick up on a few things that you said, in my experience, attachment-related issues, especially in romantic relationships, as I outlined before, can be really quite challenging to help clients navigate because they're so, you know, the word I would use would be activating, right? From a scheme or a core belief perspective, there's this kind of torn or waterfall of cognitive, behavioral, emotional threat mitigation mechanisms that get activated. And again, as I mentioned before, they can backfire. And I think you touched on this a second ago. What clinical realities did you have in mind when you were writing the workbook? I mean, I wonder if you could just maybe extend your thinking just a little bit around what you had just said. I think that was really interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're right. I kind of alluded to some of this without outright expressing a lot of it. But so what I found was that the struggles that people have who have really had a lot of trauma, one, it relates back to the way they learn to connect with or attach to others and to themselves. And that really all of us, what I learned from that population, working with that population, are things that apply to all of us. And we all have struggles with how we relate to ourselves at times or relate to others. And so there was just a lot to learn. And that's what I was thinking about, so that when we're addressing how to help people, then we're addressing it from people who are having, you know, slight difficulties, all the way to really much more significant difficulties. And I think we can capture that whole range with thinking in terms of attachment.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was, you know, what have other strategies or approaches or conceptualizations around attachment insecurity? What do you think they've got right? And where do you think they've potentially gone wrong or maybe underemphasized certain pieces that you wanted to emphasize in your discussion or consideration of this?
Very good question. There's a lot of different approaches that people take to helping, and I think they're very good, but they're different, they're distinct, and they each one is kind of missing what the other one is offering. So the way I think about this is we want to pay attention to awareness, people's self-awareness. Whatever approach you're taking, you're starting there, whether it's self-help or therapy or whatever you're doing. And in reviewing the literature, what I ended up doing was finding that I broke it down into 5 domains of awareness, and I help people explore those. So what the other approaches get right is that I think each one of them is very important. Where I think maybe some of them get it wrong is that they're either not addressing some of the other avenues, or there isn't a way to integrate them into one framework, one way of thinking. So you might go to one self-help or therapy for something, and then you have to kind of totally shift gears to get help in another area. And what I did was try to bring those different areas together. So it's not really new stuff that I'm doing so much as finding a way to integrate the different ways of thinking.
Why do you think awareness is sort of like this unifying factor in the context of attachment? It seems it's given really heavy treatment within the book. Why do you think it's so critical to navigating this particular issue?
Why is a tough question. But I can say that when people increase their awareness, that by itself shifts perspective. And you know, the question would really be, why does any approach think awareness is so important? Because they all start with that. And it really, when you are more aware, these days we talk about mindfulness, right? It's a different way of saying mindfulness. When you become more mindful, you're more aware, it changes your perspective, and you can begin to work with or process through in whatever domain of awareness that you are looking at. So that's what makes it so important and really so powerful, because a lot of times, just increasing the awareness, if you did nothing else but increase the awareness, you're seeing a lot of growth and healing and change.
Certainly there's many clinicians in the audience. There may be some who don't quite perhaps have the same level of knowledge around attachment styles and what that's all about. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind giving just a very brief overview of what an attachment style is and how they relate to relationships.
I'm happy to do that. And let me back up even a little bit further and say, what are we talking about when we're talking about attachment? What is attachment theory? So John Bowlby, the father of attachment, if you will, what he looked at is how when we are born into this world, we connect with our caregiver. And it's that connection that that helps with people's survival, so that helps keep them safe, right? If an infant is connected with their caregiver with the infant, they're going to keep them safe. And so there's this connection in terms of just survival physically, but also emotionally. That's how people develop a sense of who they are and their emotions and all of that. So you have this connection. We call that an attachment. And we learn about how we relate to other people from these initial attachments. And also in those attachments, we learn about ourselves. So we have a kind of a connection to ourselves. That's very basically attachment theory. The safer you feel, the positively that'll carry through in your life. So we have these different styles of attachment that are developed. One style is a secure attachment style. The other ones, there's 3 other ones, and they're all insecure attachment. Honestly, most of the time, I don't think in terms of the 4 styles. I think in terms of 2 things, what they call model of self and model of others. That underlies everything, and it's a great way of thinking about attachment in a way that I personally think is very useful. So a model of self is your connection, your relationship to yourself. And it's a range from I feel lovable and capable and okay in that solid kind of sense of okay, all the way to I feel unlovable, flawed, deficient, something's wrong with me. So where is your model of self on that range? And then the other model is model of others. And that's from seeing others, particularly significant others, as emotionally available. They're available, they're supportive, they're there for you, all the way to unavailable. And that could be that they don't attend to you, or they're hostile to you, or they're incompetent in being able to be there for you. But those are the two different models, model of self and model of others. And that they together direct how you relate going through your life to yourself and also to significant others in your life. If you want, I can explain the four attachment styles, but it still comes down to those two models.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And you have some really cool exercises in the book where you can plot yourself along those different axes and try to get a sense of where you are. I was kind of playing along as I was going with the book and imagining where I would fall in those domains. I guess it's a related question. I mean, I've noticed just myself as a human being, and I've certainly seen this with clients, that sometimes our attachments can feel different depending on who we're dealing with. Is there variability within our attachment profile depending on who you're talking about?
That's a great question. And it gets to the heart of why it is that I look at those two models as opposed to the four domains or the four attachment styles. Because you don't just have an attachment style. It's not like if you are securely attached, everybody who's securely attached looks the same. They don't. It's you're moving along those two axes that I laid out before. So you can have a different level of attachment or attachment style depending upon where you are in your life. You know, if you're in your 20s or your 40s, you know, or before a particular relationship or after. In different relationships, you can be different in different areas of your life. So you might be a little bit more secure at home, but more insecure at work. And it changes with experience. So it's really a moving target, but you generally have a basic default attachment style, broadly speaking.
If someone's thinking about their relationships and themselves, how could they differentiate between normal relationship challenges that we all might experience and issues stemming from something that might be more aligned with a very deep sense of defectiveness or a fear of others, things like that, where things might get a little bit more unhelpful?
It's all about somebody's experience. You know, if you're really stuck and you're repeating patterns, then there are issues within the way that you attach that you may want to take a look at to move towards a more secure attachment style. So for me, at least, it's not like some objective measure, this is okay, this isn't okay. It's more like you look inside, you say, am I okay with myself and my relationships in my life? To the degree that it's yes, great, keep doing what you're doing. And to the degree that there's a problem, you may want to take a closer look and make a change.
To what extent do you think people that you've encountered have realistic expectations around relationships? Like, how much of our discontent or worry about relationships is a function of possibly unrealistic expectations?
I think that really depends on the person and the situation. And back to the self-awareness piece, the more you can be aware of what your struggles are or what your expectations are or how you're thinking, the more you can reflect on that, and then you can maybe get your expectations in line more. You can say, oh, I feel like this isn't really okay, but in my head, I know that things are going along maybe as they should be, but it's just uncomfortable for me. But this idea that you can reflect on it is what is helpful. But in terms of how much people's expectations are off track or on track, I really think that's not only to the individual, but to the situation. You may be, you know, great and very attuned and have a good sense of what's realistic. And then you may hit a particular relationship or particular situations, and you may lose that.
I want to transition to talking about your STEAM model in a moment, but I have a couple more just more fundamental kind of questions before we get there. How important do you think it is for people to understand the impact that experiences, especially perhaps early in life, have had on their overall sort of attachment style? Is that something that you'd spend a lot of time helping to someone to understand kind of where their exaggerations might come from?
I think the more that we understand where our reactions are coming from, then we can kind of, we We kind of get it. We can empathize with our difficulties, and that helps us to move forward. So it is important to the degree that maybe some experiences are keeping you stuck or caught. There's not like a magic thing. Like sometimes people will come into therapy and they think, oh, if I just pour this out, then it'll make it better. It's not like magic that you see the pattern and it makes it better, but it can be very helpful. And to differing degrees with differing people. I find some people find it extremely helpful to go back and lay out all the childhood things and what's happened. And for other people, that's less important. And it's more important to be talking about the patterns that are replaying more in the present. Or maybe it's not, maybe yes, they were set up for certain things in their childhood, but it wasn't such an issue until they hit adolescence. Or maybe they had a first relationship in their early 20s and it was very traumatic. And so really the difficulties go back to there. But again, it's the understanding yourself that is the key, because that leads to empathy, which allows for compassion, which allows for you to then be more supportive of yourself and less critical as you're moving forward.
You've mentioned something I think is really important a couple of times. Those are getting stuck in particular patterns. What do you think are some of the most common patterns that you see flowing from some challenges around attachment?
So one, I think, very common pattern individually, that what people bring individually to relationships, is if they have a particular attachment style, they have a way of viewing themselves or their relationship, and they project it out there. So if I imagine that you're going to reject me, every little thing you do is a possible rejection. And even if you're doing something that's relatively benign, I may get upset and shut down or lash out or whatever I'm doing. And so that happens all the time in relationships. We're projecting our stuff on the other person. So that's one. And that's what each person brings in. In terms of, I think, one of the most common relationship patterns, more broadly, would be that pursuit-withdrawal pattern. You have someone who is highly anxious. So they're like, you know, see me, see me, see me, you know, give me attention. They're texting a lot. They're calling a lot. They need a lot of hugs, whatever it is. And the other person is a more avoidant style. So they just need a little bit of distance. So everybody needs connection. So they get together. There's something that sparks in them. They feel connected. There's love. That's wonderful. And then the person who has more needs starts reaching for more reassurance, and the person who needs more distance steps back. And then the first person steps forward and the other person steps back. It's like a dance. Until the first person, who was anxious and trying to grab on or clingy or jealous, they finally like, okay, fine, I'm not going to get it. They back off. And then the person who had been stepping back didn't really want that much space. So they step forward and we begin the dance again. So that's a very, very common one. In heterosexual relationships, we more often see the man as being more avoidant and the woman as being more anxious. That happens more often, but frankly, it can happen in any variation.
Absolutely. So we'll keep those patterns in mind as we talk about some of the other pieces in the model, because there's, when we get to relationships, I really want to bring some of that, some of those pieces back in. So what I'd like to do is just to invite you to introduce the STEAM model that's in the book. I think it's really neat. And to maybe we can have a discussion about each element and maybe go through an example of each and how we could leverage those to help with building that self-awareness that you referenced before.
Okay, great. Happy to do it. So again, self-awareness, that's my theme, right? We've been talking about that. And it's wonderful to say, oh, be more self-aware. But what does that mean? Because we are complex human beings. And so I break it down into five domains. And the acronym is STEAM. So it's sensations. What do you sense in your body? Thoughts. What are you thinking? What do you think about what you're thinking? Emotions for the E. What are you feeling? What do you feel about what you're feeling? A is actions. What are your actions? What are your reactions? And I'm going through this quickly, but we can certainly talk about examples of each. Okay. And then the last one is mentalizing. That's for the M for STEAM. That one's a little more complicated. You know, the other ones are almost self-apparent. Do you want me to describe that now, or?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's a whole discussion in of itself. So
Let's talk about it right now. I want to go through the others and just, I have some questions about each one, but I'd love to talk about mentalizing. I agree. That's a complex one. And I think one we can spend a bit of time on.
Okay. So just as a brief explanation of it. And by the way, personally, I think it's a very jargony word, but I didn't invent it. And this is exactly what it is. So I'm going with what's out there. Mentalizing is really, do you get where a person is coming from? So if you can understand someone's mental states, their thoughts, their feelings, their fears, their angers, their desires, their experiences, if you get that, and not just in your head, partly in your head, but also in your heart, if you can connect with that, then you understand where someone's behaviors are coming from. And that allows you to empathize, have compassion, forgiveness, which is huge in relationships, all of that. And importantly, you can mentalize yourself and you can mentalize others. And you need to do both in order to have healthy relationships.
It seems to me that trust would be very important in terms of becoming a savvy mentalizer, if I can put it that way. That if you get to know the inner experience of somebody else, that you can understand that what they're saying is true, or at least their experience to be true, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
That you're not being manipulated, you're not being jerked around in some way, and that say they need to take some space, it only means that they need to take some space. It doesn't mean something else that you'll discover down the road.
And the other way, if you're really able to mentalize in a full way, you may know that this is a person I should not be trusting. That it is exactly. Not a healthy person to trust. And if you're placing your trust in them when you've already sensed that they're not a healthy person, then you need to kind of be looking at what's going on for you. So it definitely works both ways.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's take a little walk through the S-T-E-N-A. Mm-hmm. So sensations. Again, understanding where we feel things in our body. I've experienced it in my own psychotherapy. It's something that I've helped clients to sort of work through a little bit. What is the importance of understanding where different emotions, quote unquote, reside within the body or connecting to where we experience things?
It's hugely important. And I think for a very long time, we therapists missed this. But fortunately, it's also been some time since we're kind of catching up to the importance of it. So your attachment, remember we're starting with attachment there. Your attachment is biologically based. It's not like just some, you know, intellectual theory. It's the idea that it's based in our body. So our experiences, our thoughts, our emotions, those are all based in our body. And our bodies have some reactions to situations. I find that when people can give awareness to their body, it's a portal. Sometimes people have a hard time accessing their emotions, but if we can know that our stomach is clenched or our breathing is kind of, our chest is tight, and if you can stay there and be aware of it, the next thing you know, you're either aware of other thoughts or you're aware of some emotions, or frankly, just staying with the physical experience sometimes brings us to a whole nother place. Part of what I think is going on for a lot of people is, we live in our heads. You know, we're so busy living in our heads that we've discounted everything from the neck down. And so we're missing all this information and we're trying to live as if it doesn't happen. Well, our bodies are feeling it. So we're going to be acting out these experiences. So the more you can get connected with your body, the more you can get connected with what's happening in you. And then you're less likely to just be acting out experiences that are there because you can see them. And also you can allow your body to do what it needs to do, which means process it through. If I think of it like, you know, if somebody's had a good cry and you're really upset, you have a good cry. At the end of the good cry, you feel better. You haven't done anything different. You know, the situation hasn't changed, but something shifts in you. And that's true for any experiences that we have, that there's something that can shift when you can allow your body to have the experience it needs to have. And frankly, I think a lot of times we don't realize how disconnected we are from our bodies. And I don't know about your experience, but I know, like, so when I work with couples, I see it happening where they're not even aware. And I could think of certainly at least a couple of times that really stood out, but a number of times where I'm working with a couple, and I'll say, you know, the person's stuck. And to be honest, both times that I'm thinking about were with men. And I'm like, what's going on? I don't know what I'm feeling. Well, what's happening in your body? I don't know. Do you notice anything? No. And I'm like, do you notice that there's a tear running down your face? And one of the person's like, oh yeah. The other one actually had to go up and touch his face to know that it was there. Well, if you don't know that's happening, there's a good chance you don't know what you're feeling. You're not able to really process what's happening in the relationship or within yourself. It's the place to start. Does that all make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think it's so important for clients, humans, therapists, to find opportunities for stillness, right? Where we can just sort of unplug from all other things and connect with ourselves. And again, this is, I think, more metaphor than the way neurobiologically it might play out, but allow those emotions to complete.
Yeah,
I think they have like a cycle that they need to run and see themselves through. And then that energy is discharged in some way, and then you can move forward.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, there's an exercise I have in the book that I really love. I had seen some research that was done. They had pictures drawn just of the outline of a figure. And they were looking at where people felt emotions. So I have people for each emotion to color in where they feel the emotion in their body and then use a different color depending on the level of intensity. And it's great because you can learn to place, and then I have people write, what are the sensations? You can learn to then connect what your sensations are with the emotions. And us therapists, I think sometimes we forget that that is actually a skill by itself. Another thing that I thought was really interesting that I learned in researching the book is that children, they find, have this, it's like they feel it in their whole body. It's not differentiated. Whereas as you get older, it gets more differentiated. And then as we mature into our older years, it becomes less intense. So people who, you may have the experience, like as people get older, people who maybe have trouble with anger or something, they mellow, right? They mellow with the years. That's because in part at least, our bodies don't feel the experience quite as intensely. And so maybe that may be part of when we think of people hopefully get wiser as they get older, not always, but a lot of times, but maybe because we're less driven by the intensity of what's happening in our bodies, we can reflect more. And so those are just some thoughts I had, but it was a very interesting line of research, personally, I thought.
Absolutely. I know for myself, if I'm really angry and about to say something stupid, my vision will get extremely clear. It's hard to explain, but I just memorize the exact sort of perceptual experience of that. It's a very clear vision. And it's like, okay, you're activated right now. You need to be very mindful of what comes next. I find that to be hugely helpful.
I would say that is a perfect example of part of what makes it so important to give attention to the sensations, right? Because these are the experiences. And that's what I work through with patients. Like, what are the experiences that come before you've stepped over that line where you're doing things where it's just out of control? Because if you can know the before, then you can, like you did, you can say to yourself, okay, I need to be careful now. The other thing is, when you become more aware, and this is especially with anger, I find that some people just go from 0 to 10 and they're like, I don't know, it just happens. And then you start giving more focus to it and they're like, oh, well, there's a little bit of tension here. And then my brain gets going fast. And the more that they can describe it, the anger zone gets expanded. And now they can recognize the growing anger and then you kind of step in. But that's through increasing just the awareness. And I do throw in the other areas of awareness beyond sensations, the thoughts, the emotions that build, but same idea.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really nice segue to thinking about the thoughts and having that awareness. So in the workbook, you talk about thoughts and bring in some real classical sort of CBT techniques, like looking at cognitive distortions, cognitive restructuring. Did you want to elaborate on that piece just a little bit?
Sure. I do use kind of that CBT way of thinking, but I do try to approach it in a way that's often not CBT, which is, it's not to say, oh, this, let's go and correct your thoughts. It's not about correcting it so much as the awareness of it. It's still leading to trying to get it to be healthier, but it's about, at least in the beginning, you're really just expanding the awareness. And so for someone with insecure attachment, they start becoming more aware. They might start noticing the pattern of, I'm always expecting people to judge me. I'm seeing that. Or I'm always judging myself. Or when someone asks, you know, actually, I'm going to use a different example. When I'm in my relationship with my partner, when they go out alone, I notice that my thoughts turn to ones of jealousy. And they start seeing the patterns, right? And then they can start to separate out. And then they can reflect on the patterns like, okay, I see my partner is going out. I see that I'm having jealous thoughts. Do the jealous thoughts match? It's very CBT, right? Do the jealous thoughts match the situation? No, they don't. What's happening for me? And now we start to separate out. I would talk about emotional thinking from kind of more objective thinking. And you can kind of connect then with the emotions of it. And I know I'm jumping over to the, I'm moving myself into the E for emotions and be like, oh, I'm feeling very insecure. I'm afraid of rejection. And now they can explore that as an experience in their life, which may go back to childhood, right? Or wherever it goes back to. And they can get to know this is part of what they're carrying within them. And we don't even have to work on, okay, let's change that. You just, they start seeing it and they start seeing, just because it feels true doesn't mean it is true. I do that with a lot of people, trying to separate out the emotion from the thoughts. Just because it feels true doesn't mean it is true. We separate it out. And these are all the small steps in developing awareness that helps move towards healing, move towards more secure style. Because if you can then approach your partner and say, I know in my head that you're not doing anything wrong, but when you go out with your friends, I start getting really worried that you're going to leave me. I'm not sure what I should do. You know, I like don't want to let you go. And if you can have that conversation, maybe you get to the point where your partner says, you know what? I understand based on your history or whatever it is. I don't want you to feel that way. When I get there, I'll just text you. I'm there. Or, you know, if we need to touch base, we'll come up. And then you come up with a plan together. And that can help ease your insecurity and help you to be more open and develop a more trusting style or a more secure style of that kind of communication.
I want to hustle us over to actions because there's so many questions I want to ask you about relationships and, you know, compatibility. I think things I'm really fascinated to get your take on. Actions, I think, are really important. Like for me as a therapist, that's where a lot of the rubber hits the road. You have to break patterns, you get new data, you update your predictions, so on and so forth. It can be very curative. What would you want to add around that piece?
Well, you know, what I did without even thinking about it is I included actions in the example I just gave. So the feelings are one of jealousy. The thoughts are one of you're going to cheat on me. The actions are maybe telling your partner they can't leave or, you know, texting them every 10 minutes or seeing what's going on. And then the action may be talking with your partner about your struggles and coming up with something together. So that those are different, you know, some healthier, some less healthy actions that you're taking, they all merge together. And it's the awareness of your sensations, thoughts, emotions, actions that's filling out this picture, right? You're getting a richer, deeper picture understanding of yourself.
I think what's really cool about this model is it really does justice, I think, to the very fulsome nature of an attachment threat getting activated. It's just, it's just such a, the end user experiences that it's sort of so full body and overwhelming that this model really breaks it down into the constituent parts and has something to say about each one of them, which is really nice.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. In my experience, different people get stuck or overwhelmed in different places. So it allows for that flexibility. You may be like an expert at knowing what your sensations are. That's great. You could use it. It's not like we don't have to be aware, but you don't have to work on getting to know it or your thoughts or your emotions, but you may get stuck someplace. People with histories of trauma are also often stuck in the sensations place. And so we help them, you know, work through that. So hopefully the model isn't that it's like everybody has to focus equally on each thing. It's you're moving through it. It's weaving together. And that's where I like to think about that. I'm just trying to work with what's out there. So it's a great spot. You may be working through my model, working through my book and be really particularly stuck in one spot or another. Use the interventions, the activities in my book. You may be aware of other self-help models or other types of therapy. And you could be like, oh, wow, that kind of therapy or that self-help focuses on thoughts or emotions or whatever. And then you know what it is you need to focus on because it's bringing that to light. So that's a lot of what I'm also trying to do in this book is bring those things to light.
In the workbook, you talk about the importance of self-acceptance and compassionate self-awareness, and we'll unpack that concept just a little bit because I know that's something that you want to emphasize. In my experience, these two items are really challenging pieces for many clients to internalize because maybe core beliefs are very activated by this, or they don't want to be narcissistic, or there's a lot of sort of self-loathing that would come from internalizing those kind of things. Have you encountered this? And perhaps pulling from the workbook, what's a favorite strategy or two that you would think would be particularly helpful in this kind of a context?
That is a great question for us to then back up and do the M for mentalizing, because that's it. That's where the work happens. Along with the self-awareness, being able to reflect on all of those different levels of awareness and how they make sense so that you can really get where you're coming from and you can really get where your partner's coming from. So we're not trying to force someone to be self-accepting or force someone to have compassion. That doesn't work. If someone's not there, it's going to be like what you said. They're going to fight against it. It's just not going to work. So if you increase the self-awareness, what happens is the empathy can come in. And wherever it is they're not empathizing, then you just keep increasing the awareness, like what's going on here? And you start to question things. And we can talk about that more specifically, but you start to question it. And so you can really get, it's like, oh, I get it. Okay, well, if you get it, then you can maybe have some empathy for it. Sometimes people can't do that. Maybe they, because it's so ingrained in them to be self-critical, but you can still take that process and maybe if they have a child, if your child was going through this, how would you feel towards them? And then they can have empathy there. And the idea, again, we're not trying to force them to have it for themselves, but you see a light bulb go off because you'll say, you know how you have it for your child or your friend? This is what we want to help you to have for yourself. And you see the kind of a light bulb, oh yeah, but I can't do it for me. That's okay. You don't have to do it for yourself, but we want you to understand. And we know that if you have that skill for your friend or your child, then we can help you have it for you. It's a very, hopefully a very kind of gentle approach to it because that can open them to be able to be more curious, which is something else I focus a lot on, right? Increasing curiosity. And that will, with time, help people be open to more self-awareness. And again, getting back to the empathy, which is why, and I talk about compassionate self-awareness. And sometimes people, when they see it, because self-compassion is a very big thing these days, they see self-compassion. But really, for me, it's awareness, but with a compassionate bent. So that's compassionate self-awareness. And so that's what we're trying to nurture. The more you can nurture that, then the resistance to self-acceptance or the negativity, that it's like they can have self-compassion, they can be aware of the not being comfortable with it, have compassion for their struggle with it, then they can stay in that space and it will come. The self-acceptance.
Yeah, it really seems like the compassionate self-awareness is an iterative process rather than an outcome. It's something that you engage in over time. It yields different kinds of fruit over time. You might take a step back, a step forward, but it's the stance towards a process more so than an outcome. That's what I'm taking from this.
Absolutely. I could not have said it better myself. And it's a lifetime thing. It's not like you achieve it. Like, oh, I have compassionate self-awareness now. I also know how to, jump rope. It's a process because life is stressful. We have all kinds of things happen. And so we always need to come back to kind of, oh, can I understand what's happening for myself? And can I see it with a compassionate, can see what I'm going through with a compassionate understanding? Or can I see what the other person's going through with a compassionate understanding? So yes, it's absolutely an iterative process.
Okay, I want to ask you about some relationship stuff, which I think will be really interesting. You devote a whole chapter to finding a good match. And there's so much lore what we might even call folk wisdom around this, like opposites attract and things you might hear from your parents, so on and so forth. From your lens, the model, what the data tells us, what do you think determines sustainable compatibility considering all that we know about attachment?
I think the more that each person can mentalize themselves and someone else, the healthier that relationship's going to be. Because it breaks down if somebody gets upset and they can only view themselves, right? Because they have the insecure attachment style. So it all comes back to people don't care about me or I can't trust others. then it implodes. But if you can help people, or if you two people come together and they can really be there for the other one as well as for themselves, so you're not losing yourself. It's not like you can be there for the other person, but you lose yourself. But you can hold both yourself and the other. Then you've got a healthy relationship. So to me, that's key. That's, you know, it's everything, but it's a good chunk.
So you could have people who are very dissimilar, but as long as they're both good mentalizers, they're able to understand the internal world of the other, and they can get along and make their life function. You could have people who are very similar. And again, as long as they can mentalize appropriately, again, they can make their life workable between them.
Importantly, you know, sometimes people can basically be secure in their attachment style, but still be insecurely attached, meaning if something taps on their insecurity, then they lose the ability to mentalize. So, you know, you're doing great until you're, you know, in all situations, till you go back to your partner goes out with friends. That's just your thing. And then you lose the ability to really reflect on it. So if you can still reflect and be able to see that this is your struggle, then you're mentalizing. Mentalizing doesn't mean it's all fixed. It just means you have a good perspective on it. You can work with it. Non-mentalizing is you've lost perspective, and so that you can't really work within yourself or with a partner to get to a healthier place.
I've been struck as a human being by how just profoundly impaired my judgment can be when I'm activated from exactly the way that you're describing. Like in the moment, something can seem like there's no difference between reality and what I'm experiencing. And then, you know, give it a day, a good night's sleep, you know, a weekend, whatever, you come back to that same issue. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe that I was conceptualizing it in that way. I was just so in that sort of fight, flight, or freeze kind of mode. How can we put some daylight in between our reactions and actions?
So in the book, I forget what chapter it is, but I have preparing to heal, or preparing for, you know, I forget. I think it's preparing to heal. But the idea is, you're right, like we were talking about earlier, once you step over a line, once you're out of your window of tolerance, once you're in your, you know, sympathetic activation, depending upon the theory you're using. But we all know the feeling when we've just kind of lost it, lost our ability to have perspective. You're not going to have a productive stepping forward, moving through a situation. So you need to know that experience. So part of the STEAM is being aware of when your body is getting activated, and you know the pattern that it takes in increasing activation, and when it is you need to reduce the activation or become less aroused, and how you can go about that. And this reflects a lot on, I think, polyvagal theory does a lot of, you know, work that's very helpful. And if you can look at, again, coming back to attachment theory, when you're getting distressed or when you're feeling that distress, what can calm you? Well, you want to look within yourself. What are things I can do? I can sit and read. I can take a shower. I can go for a walk. Those things help me. And you also want to be able to look at what another can do to help you. So I can talk with a friend. I can pet my cat or dog. I consider a pet another. You know, you're getting calmed through that other relationship. So you want to be aware of those things. That gets you to a place you're calm enough that you can think clearly. And that's what you want to do. So STEAM can help you there. But the idea is when you're feeling very aroused, you're not using STEAM to help with the situation. You're using STEAM as a way to focus on what's happening in you to bring down the arousal, the distress. And I think that gets to your point. Then once you're calm, then you can use the STEAM to help yourself or interact with your partner in we call co-regulation, right? You're going to do things. You see they're distressed. You're tapped into the awareness of them. So we can help regulate them, bring down their distress. Maybe they can help us. And that's one of the beauties of being in a relationship. Is this idea you can be supportive of each other and help each other when you're distressed.
Another question for you, to what extent, I hope this question will make sense, to what extent do you think it's healthy to accommodate one's attachment style? Like how much flexibility is it realistic for us to have, maybe given certain experiences we might have had, or you know, especially early childhood trauma or you know, early adversity, things like that, where we know that it's on some level kind of baked into the nervous system, genes are turned on, so on and so forth. So yeah, what do you think about the notion of accommodating one's attachment style? What do you think about that?
I think we're always accommodating our attachment styles, or maybe sometimes we're just giving into them, but it's all about your experience, right? For all of us, we want to be happy. We want to have a sense of well-being. That's great. And if you are, say, anxiously attached, but you have relationships in your life or situations set up where, you know, it's okay. You really do have a sense of well-being, even though these are the areas of weakness. That's great. If it's interfering, if it's making you not happy, to the degree it's making you not happy, that's the degree to which you want to work it through. And nobody else can do this for you. You could have a partner who can help you feel safer or more secure in a particular moment. They can be there for you. We have not talked about this, but within attachment theory, they can be a safe haven. They could be a secure base to support you. They could do all of that. But the changing, the developing the safety is within you. So I think it's okay to accommodate. I think it's important to accommodate. And just be respectful of where you are. I believe, and I think research bears this out, that if you can be at home in yourself, and you can have, this is the self-compassion research, if you can have self-compassion, you will be more inclined, more open to growth, curiosity, you know, developing yourself in a healthy way, not in a way that puts you down, but in a way that says, okay, I feel good about myself in these ways. I'm struggling here. Wow, I want to be better. And so that will, there's an accommodation that's like a healthy way of growing.
Absolutely. No, I really like the way that you frame that up. I'm going to take a bit of a flyer on this question, and I'm going to be heavily referencing Jeffrey Young's notion of schema chemistry. And if someone in the audience doesn't know what that means, essentially what Jeffrey Young has proposed is that if you find yourself, say, like 10 out of 10 attracted to somebody, like head over heels, his hypothesis is that it might be activating a series of kind of core beliefs within you that are very likely to play out dramas from childhood, to put it in a nutshell. Does an overly intense attraction to someone raise any red flags for you from, you know, from the lens of attachment? Or
I don't want to jump too quick on, I think yes and, or yes but, depending upon how you want to look at it. You know, if somebody's like, they just meet someone and, you know, fireworks go up, that's great. If it's leading to unhealthy things, if you have totally lost your perspective and you find yourself doing things that really are against your own values or that are harmful to you, then we got a problem. But I don't think, I mean, I think you could probably get, not probably, you can get two people who are basically securely attached and they connect in some different ways and fireworks go off and that's wonderful. It doesn't have to be like, you know, oh, that means something nefarious. But, you know, if you know there are certain patterns you have and you're falling head over heels with someone where you know it's a repeat of a pattern, you may want to take a closer look at it, even as you're feeling that intensity, which is hard to do, but it is doable.
I was just reflecting as you were saying your answer, and I agree with everything that you said. I've been a psychologist for far too long, just being so suspicious. Every aspect of the human experience needs to be questioned on some level, but
that's what, yes, I want to be cautious about.
Yeah, absolutely. One final question for you here. How would you recommend approaching or supporting a partner who's struggling with insecure attachment issues? Like, and I guess the meat of my question here is, what's the line between co-regulation and somebody feeling subjugated or like an unhealthy accommodation of some kind?
It's an excellent question, and it's something I work with people on all the time. And it gets back to, I think I was referencing it before, somebody else cannot fix this for you. They can be a support. They can be, you know, like a safe haven where you can talk to them. But you need to work on it. So if you are looking for your partner to really prove to you that they're not going to cheat, or, you know, you're trying to like prove to your partner that you're not going to cheat, then we have a problem. You can, you know, say, so in a situation like that, it's easier for me to do it as an example, but so in a situation like that, the partner may say they appreciate the fears, they understand it, they're sorry that they're having those fears, they love them, they'll support them through it. What they're not hopefully saying is, you don't need to worry or ever worry. You know, I'm never going to leave your side. You know, we'll just do whatever it is you need for me to, you know, it's too much, because what that does is it doesn't allow both people to be individuals. If you're responding in a way where both people cannot be separate people, where one person's giving themselves up for the other one, that's overstepping a line. Or the other way, if the situation is, oh, I'm not going to bother them because, you know, that upsets them too much, or they're going to think I'm needy because, you know, I would like to hug them every once in a while. If you're totally pushing down your needs and so that you're totally separate, now that's not exactly a healthy relationship either. We need to be able to do that balance between closeness and autonomy. Anything that tells you there's too much closeness, so you have no autonomy, or there's so much autonomy that there's no closeness, you know you're in a range where there's a problem. I'm hoping that answered your question.
No, it really does. It gives some really helpful, I think, parameters for sort of thinking that conundrum through. And again, it's like it's a tension to be balanced rather than a problem to be solved, I think. And I think at different times, relationships will ebb and flow out of that sort of equilibrium.
And different people have different needs. So some people, you need to be in a relationship where there is more closeness, and other people need more space. And I don't want to pathologize that. It's a pathology when it's causing a problem.
Well, I can't believe how quickly the time has flown by. I really enjoyed this conversation. I found the workbook to be really fascinating to go through. I really like the model, as I said before. If people want to learn more about you or the workbook, where would you direct them to?
Well, you can certainly get the workbook on Amazon. And as far as learning about me and my work, my website is www.drbecker-phelps.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you for carving out some time to speak with me today. And thanks for writing such a great book. And I hope we get a chance to talk in the future.
Thanks. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.